Farmers who know their land and know about growing things know that it's not really a good idea for the first year to be planting 10,000 acres. No. Start off small, see how it goes, and look at how that business plan works.
That's Steve Allen, one of the pioneers of the modern hemp building industry and the director of the International Hemp Building Association. This is the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. My name is Eric Harlock, and on today's show, I talk with Steve Allen about building with hemp, what makes hemp an excellent building material, how the American hemp building industry compares to what's happening internationally, and what does CBD have to do with hempcrete? All that and a whole lot more, but first, let's check out a few recent hemp news nuggets. Okay, first up, this week federal banking regulators issued guidance on hemp banking. I'll have a link to that guidance on the show page, but here's what the American Banking Association had to say about it. We welcome the guidance issued today. It provides greater clarity on banks' obligations related to hemp producers. This action, which has been long sought by ABA, makes clear that banks are not required to file suspicious activity reports on hemp producers who are operating under an approved federal, state, or tribal license or plan. We are pleased that the guidance also notes that bank customers are responsible for complying with regulatory requirements surrounding hemp, not the banks who serve those customers. We appreciate the steps regulators have taken today to clarify regulatory expectations for banks, and we look forward to working with them as they develop additional guidance. Okay, next up. All right, so the Wall Street Journal reported on November 27th that the Food and Drug Administration said that it can't vouch for the safety of food and other products containing CBD because of limited information about the cannabis-derived compound's effects on the body. An agency statement listed several potential health risks that studies of CBD have uncovered, including liver injury, harmful interactions with other drugs, and changes in mood. And then it goes on to quote Amy Abernathy, the principal deputy commissioner for the FDA. We remain concerned that some people wrongly think that the myriad of CBD products on the market, many of which are illegal, have been evaluated by the FDA and determined to be safe, or that trying CBD can't hurt. And the agency also cited concerns about unsafe manufacturing practices and marketing strategies that might deceive consumers in the CBD market. I will have a link to that FDA statement on LancasterFarming.com on the show page for this episode. All right, so just one more thing before we get into my conversation with hempcrete builder and pioneer Steve Allen. This is about a crop insurance webinar. It's hosted by the National Center for Appropriate Technology. Yes, that's actually their name. It's on December 12th, next Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be about the whole farm revenue protection policy, which protects the value of the whole farm's revenue rather than any specific product a farmer grows. And for 2020, industrial hemp in seed, flower, or fiber form can be one of the products insured by a WFRP policy. So I will have a link to that registration page for that webinar at LancasterFarming.com on the show page for this episode. CBD, CBD, CBD. Everything is always about CBD. But let's not forget that there is a whole other side to this crop, apart from cannabinoids. Yes, I mean the fiber side. And so today I'm starting a new segment that I just made up. It's called Fiberside Chats. And I am honored that our first guest in this new segment is Steve Allen. He is a pioneer of building with hemp. He is the director of the International Hemp Building Association. He is the author of several books, one of which is called Building with Hemp. It gives a great background on hemp in general, and then gets into the specifics of building with hemp, and has a ton of amazing color photographs of hemp building projects all over the world. And just a heads up, we recorded this interview over Skype, so the sound quality is a little different than we're used to. But anyway, here we go. Steve Allen, welcome to the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. Could you introduce yourself for us, please?
Yeah. As I've just said, my name is Steve Allen. I'm an Englishman that lives in Ireland and has done for the last 47 years of my life. I'm working in the last 10 years as a consultant advising people on building projects primarily, but also on developing building industries and businesses around the hemp plant. For the last 20 years, I've been experimenting with growing hemp here in Ireland and different systems of harvesting and processing that might work better here than in other places. That led me into forming the International Hemp Building Association, which meant that the things I'd learnt about using the material as a building material were of really wide interest. And so I found myself being drawn more and more to that. But I discovered using it about 22 years ago. I first used it when I was building my own house. And so I was very shortly made to realize how an adaptable and quite amazing material it was for using as a building material, because it did so many things, and yet it was very natural, non-toxic type material. So promoting that, as I've done with writing a book and forming an association, has meant that I've become this sort of like a bit of an expert.
Yeah, a bit of a pioneer.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so let's talk about why hemp has these properties and why you found it great to work with as a builder, as you were making your home.
Right. Well, I was halfway through building my home, and a lot of the aspects of the house I was building, which is the one I still live in, was to make it look sort of like vernacular kind of appearance, so that it looked like it had been in the landscape for a long time. That it was that roof, which was using water reed as a roofing material, so it looked quite old fashioned. It looked quite natural, but I hadn't really learnt or discovered that much about natural building materials for the structure or for the insulation or surfaces or whatever. Particularly, I was more just interested in the proportions of the building. So I started to build this house as warm and cozy as I imagined, but at the same time making it look like an old house. And halfway through doing that, I discovered that there was this new hemp building material being promoted when I read about it in the back of The Emperor Wears No Clothes, a famous book that started off most hemp activists on the current path, certainly the original ones. And there was a company in France called Isochanvre who'd invented this system, supposedly. And so I sent off for the instruction manual, read about it, and realized you could use it as a plaster. And so I used it as a plaster coat in the house that I was building as an experiment, see how well it worked. It looked great. It made the building, gave the building that sort of a slightly old, rustic appearance. And I was asked by many of my friends that did live in old stone houses if I could come and plaster their homes. And a business evolved out of that, basically. Then I spent so much time on the phone advising people and telling people how the system worked that I thought I'd have to write a book so that at least people can read the book. Then they can get back to me with precise inquiries rather than what is this stuff.
So you were recently here in the U.S. and, you know, our sort of hemp building industry is just a little baby industry right now. What's sort of your opinion of the state of hemp building here in the U.S.?
Well, as with all hemp projects, you have to start off with the hemp. And that's probably the biggest obstacle, really, in using it, at least beginning to use it. Because the transportation of the material vast distances, whether it's by ship and shipping container that has been done into other states for the last few years just to build the prototypes to demonstrate how well it does work, that's not feasible on a long-term sustainability type route. So we have to be producing it locally in the United States. And the states, as is in Canada and in places like Australia, these vast spaces, these vast distances between where centers of population. And so it has to be more focused on a localized production, especially initially on a small scale localized. So unfortunately, there still isn't the machinery to process on site in America yet to be able to get reliable quality, good materials. In fact, there are several different machines being marketed at the moment, supposedly work as decorticators, but they don't. That's not decortication, if you actually know what you're looking at when you see the videos. But I do know of a machine that does work, and I'm hoping to be able to have that for sale, copies of that machine, later on next year. But that's another side issue. But basically, there needs to be some investment in the United States in larger scale processing as well, so right. that groups of farmers especially can then be growing the crop for that central facility, either that's co-owned by them in some sort of cooperative, or where another independent or outside investor comes in and provides that potential for them.
Right, yeah. We talk a lot about that on this show, about the importance of local supply chains and how we build these and get that local processing power. You mentioned another machine that's a good decorticator. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's only in as much as it belongs to a friend of mine. It's currently in a very remote location up in the Moroccan mountains, and is inaccessible until next spring, which is when I'm going to go and measure it all up, and we're going to start manufacturing them, getting them all tested so they have certifications, safety and stuff, and then we should be able to sell them.
Okay.
And those are the sort of machines that, when you talked about CBD farmers, that they would be able to do small-scale enterprises where they could maybe supply a local builder with some materials that he could use for renovation or artistic surface decoration in buildings, or if in slightly larger scale, to maybe build a house or two.
Right. My next question was, what does CBD have to do with hempcrete?
Well, I based the whole presentation in Ketchum, where I was just a few weeks ago at the first U.S. Hemp Building Summit. And the title of my presentation was Time to Get Serious, or What Has CBD Got to Do with Hemp Building? And so I used those letters, CBD, to highlight several of the aspects of the use of hemp as a building material, and that use of these letters as a sort of acronym started off with things like we have this complex bioengineered device, in as much as how the actual broken pieces of the core of the hemp plant or whatever, when they're decorticated, in other words, when the cortex is removed, the fibers, usually for some other industrial feedstock, that the actual wood chips are broken in a size that, you know, an aggregate tends to be perfect for using as hemp building, but the way that the structure of that lightweight cellulose core works with water vapor and insulation and heat storage is what makes it so unique. It's that interior structure of the compartments of the cell, the xylem, and the other aspects of the plant that are made from hemicellulose, but they create this structure which gives the material its physical structure to a certain extent when joined together with a binder, but also helps handle the water vapor, which also has aspects with the whole temperature and thermal behavior of the building.
Okay.
So I also then use CBD to highlight that we need to change the design of buildings, so it's cannabis building design, CBD. And then I ended up with the fact that that we can't operate in some sort of bubble. As you mentioned just before, we have a mess, basically, that humanity has made. At least I believe humanity has made it. It's a mess anyway, whether we've made it or not, still have to deal with it. So, I'm not going to get into that argument as far as I'm concerned. Anthropology.
Not an argument. Nope.
Climate change is real, and it's hardly surprising the way we've been behaving for the last 50 or 60 years. However, we have climate breakdown, CBD. And if we didn't do something about it, it would be CBD, complete bloody disaster. So that's how I use that thing. But outside of that, to try and get serious, the production of CBD, to my mind, in the way that it's being promoted, especially, unfortunately, in a lot of parts of America as a kind of neutered marijuana, is not a proper farming system. A horticultural system, possibly, but I would like to see a lot more attention going on to ecological methods of weed control, rather than either trying to burn them off or having to spend a lot of labor weeding them all. it's all very well if you have a lot of cheap labor, fair enough, people need to do something. But I'm more interested in using industrial hemp for all the ways that it was claimed to help us as a tool to address the problems we have in humanity, both for its carbon sequestering effect, for its shading of the ground and suppressing weeds, for its aerating the soil with its root structure, and for returning nutrients from the foliage as it grows back to the soil.
Right.
And providing us with food, fiber, and this biomass that we can use for especially making materials to build shelters with. And to me, those things are very, very important. To be growing something that is not suppressing weeds, is not providing a sort of rotation crop for farmers, and it's being grown with the sort of aims that the dollar signs are flashing in people's eyes, and it's not about really caring for the environment or anything else. And it doesn't absorb that much CO2 when grown in that way. And to be quite honest, even though I can see that CBD has many potential medical benefits and therapeutic benefits, let's say, I don't see the point of putting all our effort and resources, especially our investment, into something that will help us sit around feeling better while the world collapses around us.
Very good point.
We don't need a Band-Aid. No, we need a real solutions for the train wreck that humanity is approaching.
Yep, we need to disrupt the train wreck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So apart from the supply chain issues, what else needs to happen in the U.S. for this building material to sort of supplant the standard practice of, you know, building with particle board and plastic?
Well, there's two directions that could be undertaken in. One is on low tech and one is high tech. And the low tech one would be more on the level of where a local farmer is asked by a local builder to grow hemp for him for a particular project, and so he's giving the farmer a guaranteed market for his materials and his products produce in the sort of template of community supported agriculture. I don't know whether you're aware of that particular term, but where the community contracts farmers to grow things rather than grow farmers just growing things on the vague hope they might have a market for them. And so, you know, say a builder had two or three people locally who really wanted to build a hemp house. They'd seen one somewhere else. They said, no, I want you to build this house like that, and I want you to build me a house a bit like that. But, you know, where are we going to get hemp from? It's like, oh, well, Joe down the road, he's got a farm. He's been thinking about growing that stuff. Maybe we can do that. And I don't know how the regulations are still or how they will develop. But if, for instance, a university or research facility needed to be involved with that to start with, I'm sure there are plenty of architectural schools in the US right now who are thinking that would be a great project.
Is there a ratio you can give us, you know, sort of acres grown to, say, square footage of a house or something like that?
Basically. I mean, if we talk on sort of average European figures for production of industrial hemp on average farmland, you're talking anything from 6 to 9 metric tons per hectare, which is 2.5 acres roughly.
Okay.
So that's a dry material that you'd expect to get off, and about half of that roughly is the wood chip.
Sure.
And concentrating just on the wood chip, then you would need to be able to separate that from the fiber and to have it bagged nice and dry, relatively dust free. You don't want a load of dust in it just because it's just unpleasant to work with.
Yeah.
And it does affect the whole way the binders can work, or it can do anyway. But better to have not dust, but small particles of hemp are fine. And, you know, ranging between different sizes, we have a guideline of exactly what sort of particle size range the different kinds of use of hemp in hempcrete would need in our IHBA best practice guide, which you get as part of a membership that individuals can take out. There are different size ratios that work better for hempcrete or hemp plaster or loose fill insulation, but it's not so absolutely precise that it has to be exactly that and exactly that. There are different ways you can use different sizes with experience more than anything, but you know, the type of different types of binders used, the different amounts of water that are used with them, how hard or not you compress it, all can be varied. It's just a matter of getting to know the material more than anything. And I'm not very keen on setting precise standards right now, because the variety of materials that are around are quite varied, and we're incorporating even more wider range of materials that we didn't necessarily consider before. Because, okay. For instance, we're using wild hemp grown up in the Himalayas in Nepal to build with, and there the particle sizes can be massive. Because some of the hemp plants that are grown there, of course, the old cannabis plants, are like trees. You know, they're 30 feet tall with stems that start off at about 3 inches across.
Wow. When it comes to hempcrete, what can we learn from traditional architecture?
More than anything, about cooling and keeping warm. So in some parts of the country, you know, vernacular architecture, whether it's in the States or other parts of the world, are designed in particular ways to have less or more roof area, to be able to shed the rain or collect the rain or hold the heat or reflect the heat, or, you know, there are very basic things like that. You know, I've used examples just even recently in the presentation I gave when I talked about design being very important, that the old Hopi Indian sort of square Mexican type houses that you would see around that southern part of the continent, or the southern part of the States and northern Central America, would have been, you know, made with a lot of wisdom, and that they would have had, like in other hot, dry parts of the world, small roof areas so that the whole external part of the building had as little surface area as possible to absorb the heat, that had quite thick walls so that the heat was buffered. It wasn't as if it was too cold, it was just that the heat was sort of kept in balance. So okay. The buildings were cool in the heat and warm in the cool.
Right.
There are other technologies that are very, very simple, that involve towers and water, sort of small water reservoirs that can both humidify and cool buildings with no energy at all. It's just a matter of design. Mm. They call them cooling towers. They have them on a lot of buildings in the Middle East.
Okay.
And, you know, there's no reason why those sort of things can't be adopted by places like Texas or New Mexico or places like that, or even Florida to a certain extent, where you have an absolute use of air conditioning, as if air conditioning is absolutely essential, can't possibly build a house without it. I saw buildings just in Boise, in Ketchum, just recently, where there was these modern apartment blocks. They're only maybe 2 or 3 stories high, and each one of them had massive box outside that was the air conditioning unit. And the amount of energy just to keep that box like a fridge, basically, in summertime and maybe warmed up in the winter, is just ridiculous, when the building could be built to do that anyway.
Yeah, it sort of epitomizes the whole issue with building and environmental issues. Yeah.
Well, it's about design. It's about the fact that engineers have taken over. It's not about sort of architecture anymore so much as engineering. Okay, we're going to build these boxes and we're going to use this energy solution and people can live. Rather than, hang on a minute, let's work. How does nature do it? And how can we work with nature to build an envelope or a structure where people will be comfortable without having to plug in something to make them feel comfortable?
Right.
And if they do need to warm the place up or whatever, then it's not hard to add a little bit of energy maybe to do that. And so that's what we can provide with hemp, and that's what's very essential to understand from a design point of view. People will get very worried about codes and, it's going to fit as if it's just an off-the-shelf type solution like is used for a lot of modern products. Now, obviously, we are not wanting to alienate the people who work in the code systems or anything, but at the same time, we are offering an alternative marketing system, if you like, to the conventional market. And that is where things are sold because of a long-term knowledge that it works, rather than, we've got this insurance policy that means if anybody claims anything off us after the first 5 years, then our insurance will take care of that, and it doesn't matter what it is because, it's all just going to be sorted in the courts. That isn't how you should be thinking about developing products. Okay,
no.
You have standards, you want things to be safe, but there are a lot of existing technologies, if you like, that have been used and can be used, and the architects are the ones who need to get their heads around that. When it comes to codes, there are very often ways of applying hempcrete into existing codes, and there have recently been straw bale codes that have been accepted in the US that can be, and we are working on adapting them to make them suitable for hempcrete.
But those straw bale houses where they coat the straw bales in adobe.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? Yeah, those are fascinating.
Well, they don't have to be in adobe. They could be plastered with anything. But straw bale houses have become a fashion since what emerged out of New Mexico and California in the 70s and 80s, which had originally been just a sort of like a way of housing during harvest in places in Nebraska and places like that, and places of big grain area. Mm. In there, that's where straw bale houses originally, were made, right. But they weren't made to be fancy West Coast houses. But they've been used like that. To me personally, as an ecological builder, and have been for the last 30 odd years, straw bale is just a bodge. It does theoretically provide the insulation that you might need to build a comfortable house, but all the sort of other technologies that have to use alongside it, like expanded metal mesh or rebar or all these other things, are all sort of ways of trying to get over the fact that it's not really a suitable building material. you're trying to bodge that because you've solved that problem, then you bodge that to solve that problem, and it sinks a bit, so you have to cope with that. And
right.
Whereas beauty of hempcrete is that you can use it to create a perfectly modern building. You'd never know hempcrete, or you don't need to know that hempcrete's been used in it. But you'll feel the difference when you come into that.
Right.
That's the most important thing about it, is that you can feel how healthy it is. It just has a different effect. It's not really a smell, but it's like you're suddenly breathing fresher air. Hmm. As if it's healthy, because what happens is the hemp regulates the humidity levels and the temperature levels. And because, as an envelope of a structure around you, it's not sucking heat from you, because it achieves equilibrium very quickly.
Right.
It, unlike a concrete or brick house where the buildings are sucking the heat from you and you feel cold, or you're in a suffocating sealed plastic lined box that a lot of new houses, especially in America, are built out of ticky-tacky, as the song goes. You're having to use all this cooling or heating to make it livable. So in the summertime, you're turning it into a fridge, and it's close the door, you let the heat in. And in the wintertime, it's close the door, you let the cold in.
So you're proposing that people should just be comfortable all the time, naturally. but hempcrete doesn't offer like a structural component to it, right? I've seen...
It can do. There are still so much that we are developing and altering, that we are still in very early days in lots of ways, but there are now thousands of examples of really interesting buildings from all around the world. And I'm currently writing a book featuring hopefully 50 of those. It might be 40 if it's too much trouble to get the extra 10. But they're very, very different buildings, from luxury houses to small little houses for untouchable people in Nepal. So every kind of like range of structure, small little cottages built by family people, larger houses by crews. There are lots and lots of different offices, storage places, all sorts of buildings now, supermarkets have all been built using hempcrete. So we have plenty of examples. If any engineers or architects really are interested, there are plenty of examples to go and look at, either online or in actual reality, to see how people approach particular bits. There are people like me offering their expertise, and I've got a couple in Vermont I've got to talk to after you guys, who are building a house and needing a bit of advice. So there are people out there doing that sort of thing. The US Hemp Building Association has just started. They're going to be bringing people together. But at the same time, I feel that they seem to be concentrating on the problems of codes, and it's not that kind of material. Easily it can be, but it means usually somebody taking a lot of their own personal money or business money out of a business and investing it in going through a whole load of tests, so that you can say, yes, if you use it in that particular way and a fire occurs, then it will survive as a structure or structurally intact for 40 minutes or something, so that people have easy access time. But as an actual material, you can say, okay, if you use it like if you mix it at this proportions, it has that kind of a U value or R value. If you make more or less of that, then it has a higher or lower R value. And you can even make materials that wouldn't necessarily have a good R value, but they would be strong, dense enough to be able to have structural strength. So they could be used, for instance, as pillars inside inside the building, and the envelope of more insulating non-structural blocks could be put around them. There are a lot of different ways. There are, you know, it's endless. It's basically just a material. The way you use it is helping to expand the creativity of architects and designers and builders.
Okay. You had mentioned earlier the International Hemp Building Association. You're involved there. You would recommend people go check that out online?
I would definitely. I'm the director of that association. I was in Ireland just after we had our first international symposium. There was over 70 people turned up for a system and subject that very few people, more than those people, actually knew about. So it was quite successful for the first meeting in that way. That coalesced into having an association, and we then put on events most years. We have published this best practice guide, which, as I say, is a guide. I mean, there is no absolutes yet. You know, there are a lot of different ways of using the material. There are slight variations in the kind of binders that you can either mix yourself or that you can buy prefabricated, preformulated, let's say. Depending on whether your building has to be insured on some high level because it's a public structure, or if it's a small little doghouse or something you're building, you know, there's all sorts of ways of going about it.
Right.
So the association is trying to advise and help on that, and to give a marketplace of worker and an advert of our website for all the people that are company members, so people can get access to them.
All right, I'll put a link to the IHBA website on the show page for this episode.
Okay.
Earlier you mentioned the emperor wears no clothes.
Yeah.
For those people who aren't familiar with that book, can you sort of explain what the title means?
Basically, if anybody doesn't know anything about that book, it was written by a guy called Jack Herrera, a Californian man, back in the mid-80s. And there had been various parts of the book, you could say, had been either talked about or written about in previous publications. But Jack was the first person to really realize that it was all connected. And in a typical stoner manner, he realized that there was a wider implications to these things than just being separate facts. The fact that everybody from George Washington to the latest hippie being dragged off the street had been growing this particular plant for a long time, and had found it useful for a wide variety of things, from medicine to textiles to paper, and had been eating the seed and using it as oils for painting and making some durable surfaces. So it was identified as being this amazing plant, and then Jack also put together how he saw the connection between big corporate banks and industrialists who had invested in the alternatives to natural cellulose products were very threatened by the recent invention of mechanization, which would have meant that hemp could have been produced in a more industrial way without the use of a lot of manpower, and it suddenly became a possible threat to this new fossil fuel petrochemical industry, which was really starting to get hold on our basic resources or basic commodities like textiles and paper. So that, I think, is true. I think there's also another aspect to it, in as much as that in the US there had been a big growth of police forces to handle prohibition. Prohibition was a law enacted that needed a lot of policing, because of course at least half the population were ignoring it completely, and there was a lot of money to be made. And so they produced a big police force to counter that. Now, of course, when prohibition ended, what were they going to do with all those policemen? They had to keep them employed somehow. And so inventing a new prohibition was an easy way of doing that. And I think it was probably also encouraged by a lot of the banks that had also invested in the petrochemical industry, because during the Prohibition, they would have seen the Great Depression, and they would have seen how fragile society could be, and that people might just rise up. And if you had a big police force, that would keep them in line. So I think there was an element of that. That might be considered conspiracy theory stuff, but I just think that's work. I don't think it's a big conspiracy. I just think it's them trying to preserve their employment, you know. and their whole, you know, approach to monopolizing the very basic things that people all used at that particular time in history. It was the first time that monopolies on that scale had been possible. And the United States offered that possibility of having this massive single market all within one landmass that you could then try and control in a way that had been a lot more difficult in Europe with all the different languages and barriers that were created there. America was the first place you could really create monopolies. And so there was a lot of initial, you know, hustle bustle to try and protect those monopolies. And whether it was banking monopoly, or whether it was textile monopoly or paper monopoly. And of course, along with paper became information. And if you controlled information, like the newspapers or the dime store novels that were pulped out by destroying the beautiful Native American forests, by dissolving them in sulfuric acid to turn them into pulp to print lies on, you know, that's quite a feat.
Yeah. There's something I sense in this growing hemp industry that is like a change in the value system, that the old value system is... Yeah, like you said, all these monopolies, big companies, sort of coming from greed, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the result of that is this, you know, while it's still a very beautiful world, it's troubled, you know? We've got some things we need to fix.
Well, it's a lot of people will say, especially people that are in positions of power in industry or politics, will say, oh, yeah, but it's the system that's the problem. And to some extent, it is. I mean, there are a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, but this is the only system we've got, and we've got to stick with it. And, okay, it's going to take a real revolution of mind to be able to change our political system, although I have a few ideas about that. But anyway, to make it a more fair and representative system reflecting the modern world we live in. But in the meantime, there are several laws and regulations the way business works, controlling the way business works, that really do need to be changed. And one of those is that if you're a shareholder in a company, you have more rights than the workers who work in that company, the people who live around the factory facility or wherever that's creating that wealth, and over the whole environmental system that it operates within. And that, to me, is criminal. If a managing director makes a decision that goes against the shareholders, he can be put in jail. And that's crazy if that decision especially is for the benefit of the workers and of the environment that he's operating in, which is what should be the first priorities, not the bloody shareholders. And to me, that's something that's got to change immediately, because that would change the whole way that business worked. There's plenty of business of managing directors who would like to make a decision that wasn't purely about the bottom line. Obviously, everybody wants to keep their business afloat, but sometimes there are decisions that might mean that, you know, everybody in the factory is happy and, you know, the profits are down a few percent, you know, big deal.
So you want people to live in comfortable houses and just be comfortable in the world doing their things.
Well, that is a big ask. I know it's a big ask, but we'll see.
One last question. What advice would you give to farmers? So I'm always concerned about farmers getting the short end of the stick as this industry develops. Do you have any words of wisdom or something to add to that conversation?
I do. I'd say, right, well, to start with, be, you know, as most farmers are, be cautious. Now, I'm talking to farmers here, not entrepreneurs who think they're farmers because they've contracted somebody to grow some land, or they've got hold of a load of land they've never seen before and think they can just grow 10,000 acres of hemp when they've never done anything like that before. So farmers who know their land and who know about growing things know that it's not really a good idea for the first year to be planting 10,000 acres. You know, but no. Start off small, see how it goes. And look at how that business plan works. Obviously, you'll have an idea of how much the hemp is going to cost, how much whatever fertility you might need to add to the soil is going to cost, what kind of cost there are to ploughing the soil and sowing the seed, and then you need to look at how you're going to harvest it. Now, there are ways of doing all those things with very basic standard machinery. It's just a matter of on what scale are you going to try and do things. And if you're going to do things on a scale where you want to just provide for a couple of houses in the locality, or one builder or a couple of builders, maybe they're building three or four houses, then you could do it with just an ordinary plow, an ordinary seed drill that would probably be, these days, be a pneumatic seed drill, blowing the seeds in a controlled way into the furrows in the ground, and then covers it over as it goes. And then you would cut it with just an old-fashioned mowing bar. And let it fall down and then gather it up, as people have done in the early days of the hemp revival, when hemp started to be legalized in America, by gathering into sheaves and sticking it in the field, as people would have done for hundreds of years.
Yeah,
that's a way to start. You get a handle for the whole material and stuff. Or you can say, okay, we don't want to be messing about that sort of thing. We're big farmers, we like driving machinery around. Well, bearing in mind that we are trying to reduce our carbon emissions, you know, the smaller the machinery we can use, the better. But people do use things like forage harvesters, which are the sort of things that go into a field of maize or something that's not being grown for human feed, but it's been growing maybe for animal feed, where they'll just go in and chop the whole thing up and spew it out the back, and it'll then be maybe dried a bit or put into bales or in siles or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, there are machines that will harvest a crop like hemp and throw it out the back chopped but not decorticated. And then it's a question of, like, okay, how are you going to decorticate that? Now, you know, it's possible to develop your own processing with hammer mills and dust extraction and shaker chains, elements that might be familiar to some of the farmers around, that might have an old weed whacker that works off the side of a tractor. They might have the shaker chains from the inside of some old combines, and they might be able to make up their own machinery. It has been done in the southwest of France, but you know, ideally, you're going to either be able to buy next year a towable machine that you could put sheaves hand-fed through a machine and end up with two or three houses or more, maybe 10 houses worth of material in 6 months.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so, you know, that would be just by, you know, processing during the winter. I mean, you know, there are so many elements to how this particular technology can fit into society. It can fit into society where farmers get together, whether they form an actual legal cooperative is up to them, but they can create some kind of cooperative enterprise and get themselves some sort of shed. Maybe one of them has got a shed that they're not using, or they know there's an empty one, and buy a decortication unit, which, you know, to be able to produce fairly good materials and package them in a way that the industry accepts, fiber and wood chips, you can get, you know, and I can help people get a factory that would cost $2 million.
Hmm.
Right? And that would process up to like 4 tons an hour.
Wow.
And so then you're talking about maybe 1,500 acres or 3,000 acres or 3,500 acres. You know, it's you know, where, and then you're talking about maybe expanding that, doubling that, and having, you know, 8 16-hour shifts or 8-hour shifts, but two of them a day, you know, or even running the whole thing 24 hours a day.
Right.
There are ways of scaling up, but of course then you've got to have markets. Now, when you're talking about that big factory system, and you're talking about that many thousands of acres of material within a 60-mile radius or something, so you're not having big transport costs, if you're talking about that kind of scale, then obviously you're thinking about either directly manufacturing some kind of particle board and or fiber insulation and or modular housing made from those elements,
right?
Or hempcrete blocks, or selling the materials loose that people can come and buy to use on their own projects, and maybe a renovation project or a small extension to a building, or, you know, like a self-build sort of type.
Yeah,
supply.
Yeah.
And that, to a certain extent, all those things can be done from one processing factory with just the different add-ons at the end. So there are lots of different ways that it can be expanded into something that is much more industrial, that's creating a faster solution to a lot of the other social problems we have, like housing.
Right, right, right.
You know, and the energy use of existing housing. You know, I'm sure there are ways of developing cladding systems that can just be bolted onto the outside of an existing house to make it work a lot better than it does.
Right, right.
The sort of drywall and fiberglass interior can be sort of regulated better if it has hempcrete on the outside of it, or maybe that has to be removed and we can apply very easily a pre-fabricated in some way panel to the outside of that to make it work. problem.
So many options, right?
There are a lot of different options, but we definitely aren't all going to be building new homes. There's a lot of homes that need to be, you know, repaired, basically, or you know, brought up to scratch. And that's the real challenge. And that's the real challenge for builders, to be able to identify that and to work, okay, we're going to use this material to do that. And I don't think that once you've done a few, or you've done a small section to prove something to the local planners, usually I've found that once they'll, if you describe it to them verbally, they'll say, "Oh, I don't know about that." And when they actually drag down to actually have a look at it, they go, "Oh, that's no problem. I didn't realize you meant that."
That's Steve Allen, director of the National Hemp Building Association. You can find more info at hempbuilding.com or on the show page for this episode at lancasterfarming.com. So you heard us talking about the Jack Herer book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes. If you haven't ever seen this book, you should check it out. The whole thing is available for free at jackherer.com, jackherer.com. And how the title of the book sort of relates to the whole hemp industry is fascinating and probably deserves an episode of its own. But for today, that does it for me. If you have questions or comments or just want to share some ideas, please send an email to podcast@lancasterfarming.com. My name is Eric Herlock. I am the digital editor at Lancaster Farming Newspaper, the greatest agricultural newspaper in the world. You can check us out online at lancasterfarming.com or on Instagram at lfpodcasthemp. So until next time, I'll see you in the newspaper. This episode, episode 62 of the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast, is copyright 2019 by Lancaster Farming, which is part of the Steinman Communications family. Today's show was written and recorded, edited and produced by Eric Herlock. Most of the music you heard was courtesy of Tin Bird Shadow, but special thanks to Pete Seeger and Malvina Reynolds. She wrote the song Little Boxes, and we heard a little snippet of Pete Seeger singing it. Industrial hemp.